I returned to the beauties of a Cleveland spring to 10 days in Israel. My purpose for going was to participate in the annual conference of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, at which I was scheduled and did deliver the opening address. The conference decided some years ago that once every 7 years we ought to meet in Israel for many reasons. Israel, of course, has a rich reservoir of men and women of learning and sensitivity with whom it's good to meet and to exchange ideas. It's very useful to take your pet projects and your assumptions and to see how they look when you analyze them within the context of a very different social framework, political order. Of course, we wanted to express our emotional solidarity with the people of Israel, Klal Yisrael, particularly so at this time when they are besieged on all sides. And finally, we wanted to express our interest in the new attempts by various communities within Israel, small groups of people, to develop some form of contemporary Jewish expression, religious expression, which should not be bound and limited by the authoritarian posture of Orthodoxy. Though it had not been planned in this way, this last purpose preoccupied a good bit of the conference. Israel, as you know, held elections on the last day of 1973. And at the polls, the electorate withdrew from the Labor Party, the party which has governed Israel these past 26 years, the mandate for six of its seats. It no longer commanded even a bare majority within the Knesset for the first time in the history of the state. A coalition government obviously was a requirement. And at that point in time, the traditional partners in the government, particularly the National Religious Party, made up of the political arm of the Orthodox community, increased its demands for partnership in the coalition, even though it too had lost several seats at the election. The National Religious Parties demanded that they be given four portfolios in the cabinet instead of three. They demanded that they be given freedom of say, of vote, when it came to the final political agreements with whoever the agreement will be with as far as the West Bank is concerned. The Orthodox Party have some particular interests in Hebron and elsewhere. But most critically, they demanded a revision in the definition of the term Jew as it applies legally in Israel, particularly in the matter of the law of return. As you know, under the mandate, all of the religious communities, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, were given control of their own rules as far as the laws of personal status, marriage, divorce, inheritance, and the like. And each of these communities, in turn, gave to its ecclesiastic group control of those areas. So the church law, canon law, governed within the Christian community, the Sharia, Muslim law, governed within the Arab community, and halakha govern within the Jewish community. 1948, when the state was established, Israel was again, as it is now, besieged. War was on. No one wanted an internecine quarrel. So rather than change the forms, the religious community in Israel, the Orthodox community, was simply allowed to continue this practice of control over the laws of personal status. And now in 1974, they demanded that another brick be placed in the wall of control by which all of the domestic sides of Israeli life are governed by the halakha. In effect, the demand, which had to do with giyur, which is the rules governing conversion, insisted that giyur, conversion, be done kahalacha, which means in the case of a woman that it involve a visit to the mikvah, baptism, immersion. In the case of a man that it involve brit, circumcision. And in both cases, that the final authorization of the conversion be certified by a rabbinic beit din, a rabbinic court. Had this demand been acceded to, a number of families who have settled in Israel, olim, would find the status of their marriage, and particularly the status of their children, questioned because they had been converted outside of Israel by liberal or conservative rabbis who did not make these particular demands. And all of us who operate independently outside of Israel and who believe in the integrity of our own Jewish forms would find ourselves under pressure to submit these forms to some kind of orthodox supervision, if only to preclude later on some question arising in Israel as to the authenticity of the conversion in which we had been involved. This is obviously something that diaspora Judaism, for the most part, did not want to accept, and within Israel would only have added confusion as far as the status of individuals were concerned. Now, this demand, made precisely now, was shoddy at best and certainly scandalous. Scandalous because it set up a division within the Jewish people at a time of great danger when divisions can should hardly be tolerated. There are enough enemies outside the gate without worrying about our quarreling among ourselves. It was shoddy to come at a time when the religious parties had actually lost the loyalty of people. It was clearly evident that though a 25 or 28% of the state is orthodox in its practice, only 8% of the state was willing to vote for these religious, these political organizations which presumably express their demands. Because of the rather high-handed and arrogant way in which they have gone about over these last 2.5 decades in demanding their rights and in invoking them. And it was shoddy also because it was clearly a political move designed to attack when you are in danger yourself of being attacked. We sometimes forget that liberal Judaism, non-Orthodox Judaism, did not develop simply because we were not as pious as, because we did not want to observe all of the rituals as, but because in many ways we found the halakha, traditional forms and norms of Jewish life, to be morally unacceptable in our time. A little article appeared in the Jewish, in the Israeli press on Monday of this week, which spoke of a letter sent by the government to the United Nations peacekeeping forces who have now interposed themselves along the Suez Canal asking for their help in speeding up the search for some 230 plus a few bodies of men who fell during the October War. And there was some urgency to the appeal. It was hoped that the United Nations could interest the Egyptians in speeding up the search. Now, why this letter? Why this urgency? I have a cousin who lives in Jerusalem, who's a psychiatric social worker. And during the war and after, one of the tasks to which he was assigned was to bring the news of a death to the families of soldiers who had fallen in battle. In one case, a young man who had been part of a tank crew had been killed. His tank had been shot. And as you may have read in the papers, there was some fault in the hydraulic system of these American tanks, so that they tended to explode when they were hit. But when the tank was hit, the crew jumped out. Four of them got out. And the crew ran to a tank nearby and jumped into it and began to continue the fighting. They didn't look back. The tank exploded. And when after this particular battle was over, people returned to this exploded tank, they found that the heat generated by the explosion of the hydraulic system had been such that the body of this young man who had been left behind had been cremated, that even the dog tags were simply molten metal. There was no witness, no eyeball proof of his death. And as a result, according to the halakha, his family cannot sit shiva. There cannot be a funeral. There cannot be a memorial stone or memorial service. And his young widow, some 20 years of age, is put into the status of an aguna, of a woman whose husband is missing and who, under the traditional law, is not free ever to remarry until some casuistic way can be devised by rabbinical courts, hopefully to free her from this status. Now, the urgency of this letter is directly related to these double tragedies. The death is cruel enough, but to have the family, the widow, put into this state of permanent limbo because of an archaic law which was devised centuries ago, when men left on long business trips and sometimes disappeared, as it were, off the face of the earth for years and decades, only to return having been captured by pirates and then ransomed. Once upon a time, in other words, it made sense to have such laws, concerned if you were concerned with the purity of the family, because people could disappear. But in the intensity of a modern battle, with the immediacy of our modern communication systems, this whole concern has been obviated, but the law is there. And it was for reasons such as this that we broke with the halakha. And each of these tragedies, which is a reality in Israel, is one that was a festering wound which the religious party sort of force the people to forget about or not be able to focus on in the election by demanding more rather than allowing people to criticize them openly for the tragedies that they were compounding now. After some 40 days of bargaining, January and early February, the National Religious Party finally agreed with Mrs. Meir to form a government. And as is often the case in Israel, there was a solution which was no solution. There was a temporary accommodation devised. Mrs. Meir agreed to form a cabinet-level committee, which she herself would be the chairperson. A committee to investigate the whole question of giyur, of conversion, to meet with leaders of all religious groupings within Judaism and to make a report to the whole cabinet within a year as to any necessary changes to be made in the definition of a Jew as it applies legally in Israel to the law of return. Obviously, any of us who are concerned with civil rights, decency, and humanity, any of us who understand, as we do very clearly in the West, the advantages of the separation of church and state, can only bemoan the fact that true believers at this time chose not to be patient, not to accommodate themselves to the needs of the whole community of Israel, but to interpose and insist upon some very special demands of their own. When Mrs. Meir appeared before the conference, as she did one morning, she pleaded with the conference for patience. She asked the men there and those whom they relate to in Israel not to shake the boat. Israel, she said, cannot afford a Kulturkampf, an internecine quarrel of high temperature and anger. And of course, she will have her way. The liberal community generally understands the need for accommodation in matters such as this. It's a tragedy that the believing community, in quotation marks, does not. And this is a festering wound which Israel will someday, in the not too distant future, have to face. Now, this whole issue is a minor one in a time when the whole survival of the state is at issue. But I begin with it because it is typical of the domestic involvements in Israel today, and typical of the reasons that so many with whom I spoke, men and women whom I have a confidence in, whose judgment I respect, are very, very much involved with the need for a major national domestic reform. What surprised me in Israel was that there was less conversation about survival, about the West Bank and the Golan Heights and Suez and Mr. Kissinger and Mr. Joubert than there is in the United States. There's a great deal more conversation about domestic matters, about the lack of a clear national purpose at the moment. Mrs. Meir's compromise, her 40 days of handling in order to stay in office, all these symbolize to sensitive Israelis a way of life which they want to put behind them, an older way, a way which the tensions and the exigencies and the straitened circumstances of the post-October period can no longer tolerate. They've had enough of band-aiding. They've had enough of compromising. They felt that it was a greater defeat for Israel to have gone through these 40 days of political haggling in order to form a cabinet which was in almost every way identical to what existed before the December elections than the October war itself. The October war was brutal. 2,600 young Israelis lost their lives. While I was there, the government published a little white book which listed the name, the rank, the address, the age of each of these 2,600, and it was heart-rending to see families, friends, sweethearts, wives coming to the post office where they were available to get the book. The war was costly. I don't know how economists figured out the final cost of a war, but it was certainly in the tens of billions of dollars. And it was inconclusive. It began with certain defeats. It ended with what seemed to be a partial victory, the crossing into the west bank of the Suez Canal into Egypt. But it's clear that it did not end. There have been 12 straight days of fighting just this last period on the Golan Heights. The war was brutal, it was costly, it was inconclusive, it was unwanted, certainly. Somehow it seemed, as you try to understand how Israelis were reacting to this war, that what the war meant to them was an end to their youth. An end to the sense that there's always be a miracle. An end to the sense that they were somehow immortal. That the laws of emerging states, the laws of growth and death, simply did not apply to this new miracle, this thing which we call Israel. What you sensed in Israel was the recognition that all of us arrive at individually when we move through adolescence into adulthood, that we will age, that our talents have certain limitations, that we can't do anything simply because we want to do it, that there are no guarantees that we're going to be successful, that there are no guarantees that our lives are going to be secure or happy, that we're going to have to live with as much dignity as we can, facing the future as best we can, whatever come what may, whatever will be. I found a great deal of this que sera, sera, you know, whatever will be attitude among the Israelis. And that, I think, accounts in part for their lack of conversation. I won't say concern, but lack of conversation about matters international. They know that whatever government is in power will do whatever it can to maintain the security of their borders. They know that they are prepared individually to fight, to lay down their lives if they must for their survival. They don't have to have their noses rubbed in any longer into the facts of international morality. They tried to be moral. They went out into black Africa and they offered their schools to young Africans and they offered their technicians to emerging African states. And in the first days of the war, all of these states broke off their relationships with Israel. They watched Europe, a Europe which prides itself on its traditions of culture and of civilization, bending its diplomacy because of oil. Typically, an article appeared in the Israeli papers out of Stockholm, Sweden, about a week ago. You'll recall that during most of the Vietnam War, Sweden took a very, very high-minded position about American imperialism. And Sweden welcomed the deserters from our army and the conscientious objectors. And the Swedish premier, Olaf Palme, a graduate of nearby Oberlin, was given to sermonics about peace and justice and the needs of the third world, and so on and so on. So much so that our government finally broke relations with Sweden, which were only reinstituted this last week. Well, this last week, when we reintroduced our ambassador to Stockholm, and Stockholm sent an ambassador to Washington, the Swedish government announced that it had entered a multi-year, multi-billion dollar pact for oil, not with Saudi Arabia, not with Kuwait, but with Libya, with Gaddafi, the worst bastard of them all. Egypt talks of accommodation. Saudi Arabia demands Jerusalem, but perhaps accommodation. Gaddafi talks of blood and drowning Israel in the sea. Olaf Palme finds no difficulty in signing a multi-billion dollar pact over many years with Gaddafi. And the article itself, which is by a Swedish correspondent, is worth reading to you, because it's very clear the price that the Swedes are prepared to pay. Libya has undertaken to supply Sweden regularly with oil for 10 years in return for technological assistance in carrying through a program of modernization and industrialization. It is the first arrangement of its kind to be concluded between an Arab oil producer and a Western industrialized country. Judging by the Libyans' shopping list, they have ambitious plans. Cement, steel, and paper are in it, together with hospitals, schools, and prefabricated housings. Assistance in bringing agriculture up to date is also included. Oil tankers are to be ordered. Libya apparently proposes building up a national fleet large enough to carry all or most of its own exports. The Libyans have asked for aid in developing nuclear power, to which the Swedes have agreed in principle. And in due course, a reactor is expected to be delivered. It is clear that the Libyans want to bypass the big oil companies. The Swedes are not averse to the idea either. The deal secures for them a source of supply directly related to a producer. Abdul Salem Ahmed Jalud, the Libyan Prime Minister, visited Stockholm earlier this month to sign the agreement, told a press conference that he was glad to see that Sweden was on the Arab side in the Middle Eastern dispute. On that account, he indicated, Libya would be honored to supply all the oil required. This was the first concrete result of a policy of quiet readjustment of Swedish foreign policy. For years, Sweden, although neutral, has consistently expressed pro-Israel sympathies. In previous conflicts between Israel and the Arabs, Swedish leaders have not hesitated to make public and indeed emotional speeches in favor of Israel. But after the last Middle Eastern war, the Swedes had noticeably changed. The Social Democratic Prime Minister, Mr. Olof Palme, not usually reluctant to condemn wrongs and take sides, was distinctly cautious and reserved. Meanwhile, in a round of private talks, the Swedish diplomats assured Arab leaders that Sweden's pro-Israel stance, if indeed it could be described in precisely those terms, was now in process of revision. Sweden had far more understanding of the Arab position than before. This might possibly have had something to do with the diplomatic isolation of Israel, not to mention the imposition of the oil embargo. The Arabs accepted this act of contrition. Eventually, the Swedes were given to understand that they would no longer be numbered among Arab enemies. But only with the Libyan agreement has it been shown that Sweden is counted among Arabs' friends. Mr. Jalud said that Sweden was the kind of country with whom Libya ought to deal, since both nations were progressive. He was not visibly put out by Mr. Palme's corrective statement that Sweden was neutral. Neutrality, Mr. Jalud implied, was a comprehensive word, and it ought not to separate friends. Now, Israel is surrounded by a sea of self-interest and of hypocrisy. The Israelis recognize that oil and self-interest play a major role in international affairs, and they have seen just how much they can count upon the goodwill of men of goodwill. They know that they have to count upon themselves, and they know that they're not all powerful. 3.5 million in a world reaching towards 4 billion people. Diplomats can always write justifications and rationalizations and pompous prose, moralistic tones for any position their country sees it advantageous to take. But I did not find in Israel any despair, any sense that the future was inevitably tragic. There was a recognition that time is not only on the Arab side, but there are already divisions between the oil-producing countries among the Arab powers, some of whom are left-wing and some progressive and some centrist and some feudal. There are great divisions in between East and West. The détente is not today what it seemed to be 6 months ago, and there are great divisions in the West itself. It is clear that as long as they are willing to pay the price, they feel that there will be an Israel. What concerns them is what kind of Israel. Their concerns are for a kind of purging of the materialism, the indulgence, the sense of power, all those forms of life which have grown up in Israel over the last 15 years particularly, and which now can no longer be afforded or tolerated. They were disturbed, as I indicated to you, by an election which proved nothing. They wanted to vote certain people out, and they found that the lists were juggled in such a way that they had voted people out, but they were somehow still in. If elections were held today, the Labour Party would lose even more votes. About the third or fourth week of the haggling over the forming of government, the Israeli newspaper Davar had a headline, "For God's sakes, Golda, go. Shame Adonai, Lchi, get out." They respect her. She's a tough-minded, effective leader. She's too old. She's too tired. And as long as she remains, a whole minion of other people remain in power. What Israel wants above all is a series of new faces, new voices, new hopes, a verbalization of a new set of principles. And all this will require another election or perhaps two more elections in short order, and certainly it'll also require major electoral reform. Because the electoral system in Israel today is not only cumbersome, but it makes it almost impossible for new faces, men, women, to arise and to gain quickly widespread popular support. Israel is burdened today above all else by a terrible, terrible inflation. Prices rose in Israel by 8%. In February alone. We complained here in Cleveland of an 8.5 or 9% inflation during all of 1973. In Israel, prices have rose perhaps 30% since October. The budget which was submitted to the present government, by the present government, to the Knesset, suggests that the average Israeli will have to tighten his belt to lower his standard of living by 4.5% during 1974. Now, you've got to multiply that number by 2 or by 3 or by 4. What it means simply is that housing is out of reach, that foods have become terrifyingly expensive, the basic services are sometimes almost prohibitive. The cost of living is running at an escalated rate of inflation. Let me give you some figures. During February alone, the cost of livestock feed went up 45.9%. The cost of cooking oil, 41.2%. The cost of sugar, 58.8%. The cost of biscuits and cake, 26.7%. The cost of rice, 24.6%. The cost of butter, 41.2%. The cost of milk, 48.6%. The cost of eggs, 41.1%. The cost of bread, 44.7%. The cost of cheese, 52.8%. The cost of fish, 35.4%. Vegetables and fruits rose about 10%. Now, runaway inflation does many things. It destroys the ability of people to provide adequacy for their families. It turns people sour. And there has been a rise of the number of people who want to emigrate from Israel. The soft, the weak, the materialist. These people look down the road and they see a society which for a considerable period of time will not be able to provide the good life. And though the numbers are not frightening, they number in the tens and perhaps in the several hundreds, but in percentage terms it's a rather high number. The numbers who are applying at the Canadian embassy or the Brazilian embassy for admission to those countries is on the increase. But most Israelis have no desire to leave. They love their country. It's a country they themselves built. It's a country which is tied to them by deep emotional knots, history, the death of the pioneers of their own sons and daughters in its defense. But what they know they need is a new sense of national purpose, a new sense of national coherence. Israel was founded by pioneers who combined two idealistic themes. The theme of land, of the pioneer, of using one's hands and one's sweat to build a good society, to turn the blighted into the green, and a theme of socialism, of cooperativism, of community. They would build there a society in which there would be true community, true association. People would be chaverim, comrades. Now, over the years, they've tried to hold to these dreams. But as the land filled up, less and less people were involved in agriculture, in livestock, on the kibbutzim and the moshavot. And as people came to the city, they moved away from association and from community into a more mercantile, competitive, urban atmosphere. And they lost this sense that ties neighbor to neighbor in total shared enterprise. And no one has come in Israel who could voice for them and set an example for them of a new and deeper and more contemporary social vision. And that is what they need more than anything else. They know that their school system is old-fashioned, too much geared to repetition, to rote. They know that the economy has been allowed to develop too much in terms of providing the luxuries, the good things of life. Not enough has been devoted to building up the essential industries of a nation. They know that many of them have pulled away from community responsibility, gone into teaching, gone into a profession, gone into their business and not involved themselves in the business of government. Government was left to the bureaucrats. It's one of the problems of Israel. Many an Israeli has been essentially non-political in the way in which Europeans tended to use that term. They want a new liberation of the spirit. They want a sense that The lowering of their standard of living is truly worthwhile because when they emerge from the end of the tunnel, they will have about them a society which has the value, the intrinsic merit of being humane, being Jewish, being sensitive. And they're troubled. They're troubled by what they see as the growing materialism. They're troubled by the amount in which one's life depends upon protexia, whom one knows in order to get something done. They're troubled by the lack of flexibility in the social order, so that it doesn't seem to be able to cope with sudden challenge and the need for sudden change. They're troubled by a religious orthodoxy which has stifled the growth of in any major way of new forms, more dynamic, more contemporary forms of Judaistic expression. Many things trouble them. Almost all of these of a domestic concern. And this is really what I hadn't expected. This is what they wanted to talk about. The need for educational reform. The need for election reform. The need for reform of the way in which urban life is governed. They said the yiriyas, the town councils, are as heavy with bureaucracy as the national government itself. They want change. They want this liberation of the spirit. And as yet, they don't quite see how all this is going to take place. It troubles them that young Israel and middle-aged Israel no longer seem able to communicate with each other. And this is not a generation gap in the American sense of the term. It's rather that middle-aged Israel, at least those who are active, tend to be European. And the majority of young Israel tend to come from the Oriental Jewish communities. And in young Israel, there is not the sophistication, the middle class mentality, the middle class set of mores and standards which middle-aged Israel brought over with it or was raised into. Young Israel is good technically, technologically, with its hands, works hard, but it seems to lack many of the intellectual capacities. It seems unable to take advantage of the university system. And this is troubling. And young Israel seems not to know how to go about becoming politically and socially effective. Most of this young Israel was raised in communities or within families who come from traditions where the government was the enemy. In Morocco, in Algeria, in Yemen, in Iraq, the government was totally other. You stayed as far away from the government as possible. In distance, there was safety. And they don't know the techniques of creating town councils and participating in them, of creating effective forms to demonstrate, to secure the rights, the advantages, which they themselves need. And so there's a very definite sense that those in power now do not really understand the needs and the hopes and the expectations of those who fought but don't yet know how to fight for their rights or what they think are needed. Israel today seems to be a middle-aged country. While we were there last week, the universities opened up again for the first time since the October War. The 18, 19, 20-year-old age group is for the most part still in service. And since they are serving in the Golan and in the Sinai and the West Bank, you simply don't see them. They are not in the cities. You don't have the same sense of buoyancy, of youth, that you got when you visited Israel 2, 4, 8 years ago. But the young people are there. The state is being shouldered by their own sacrifice. I must say with it all that I liked Israel better this time than I did 2 years ago, or 4 years ago, or when I went to Israel just after the June War of 1967. I didn't like the self-confidence, the exaggerated self-confidence, which I found in Israel then. I didn't like the sense that I've heard in resonating in many voices, we alone know how. We've got it made. We know the answers. We have the best society. Now I heard sensitive, serious people talking seriously and sensitively about real human problems which they hope to meet and to confront. I was meeting an adult community and not a community on an emotional binge. Since I do not believe that God guaranteed to any of us the good life as television describes it to us, I'm not convinced that those things which truly satisfy man are purchasable, depend upon one's standard of living. I feel that over the months, the men and the women with whom I talked will coalesce and find ways to solve the real problems which for the first time they're clearly seeing, and that a better Israel will emerge, an Israel more concerned with human values and less with simply the posturings of strength. All this, of course, depends upon military security. Israel will walk a very dangerous road internationally in the months that lie ahead. I don't know what those months will bring, and I don't think anyone else in Israel or out does. But there's no breaking of the will. There's no running away and hiding. There's no throwing up of the arms in a posture of spiritual defeat. What needs to be done, they will do. Of that I'm convinced. The leaders who emerge after this period of trial and testing will be better leaders. That is more appropriate to the needs of 1974. They're not the people who are on the scene today. Israel needs a whole new set of characters. But you'll find them, because the human resource there is a good one. How shall I end and signal what I'm trying to say? One day I drove up towards the Galilee and the Golan. And when I drove back, I came along the Jordan River through the West Bank. I was driving myself. I picked up on the highway several young soldiers. I dropped most of them near Jericho, and one I brought back with me to Jerusalem. We talked. He came from a Turkish Jewish family, been in Israel for some 3 or 4 generations. He was returning to Jerusalem for a wedding. He'd received a 2-day leave from the army for his uncle's wedding. I was invited, by the way, to the wedding. I didn't have a chance to go, unfortunately. He had entered the Technion to be an engineer. He'd finished 1 year, and then had been called out for